Welcome, everyone, to our session on modernizing legacy software assets. Bit of background about myself and about the session and what we're trying to achieve here. My name is Chris Jackson. I'm our lead architect for enterprise application compatibility in our global services organization. I've spent the past 5 to 6 years helping customers move forward off of our older operating systems. Given that that was kind of a mouthful just to say what I did in typical Microsoft fashion, in 30 words what you can capture in 4, I usually just go by the app compat guy. And one of the challenges that I've seen lately is that we have gone through and kind of duct taped all of our stuff together to help, you know, in enterprise customers and sort of trickling down and spreading that knowledge to other customers, we've duct taped all of their software together. We've got it barely working. Most Microsoft products contain a compatibility infrastructure to keep things working, kind of. The outcome of that, though, is that it's really possible to come out on the other side of, hey, I'm used to have Windows XP and now I've got, you know, Windows 7, and the only real tangible difference is same old stuff running the same old way, but now instead of blue borders, they're see-through. And so that's one of the things that I'm looking to try to fix. How do we take this legacy software, all these very valuable assets, and move them forward? And I'm not really sure how the conversation's going to go specifically, because it's the first time I've done it. So what I would request from you is please fill up the feedback columns in the reviews with how could we make this conversation better, because we're not having it yet. You know what we're really good at? We're really good at applying duct tape to your old stuff to get it working. You know what else we're really good at? We're really good at saying, if you're starting a brand new application today, here are the technologies you should build off of. What's a lot harder is to say, I have all of these existing assets, all of this valuable IP encoded in C++, encoded in VB6 or 5 or 4 or 3, encoded in sometimes COBOL, and I don't want to lose that investment. You can't just tell me to throw it away. Yet we can't leave it there forever because then we're not taking advantage of the device. So the question is, how do we do that both one by one and then for an entire organization? Given the title of the session, I have no idea what mix of folks showed up. How many of you write code for a living? So about half of you. And how many of you manage other people's code for a living? Right? And I usually and it's about half and half. This is going to be fun. I usually think of it as being sort of the two dichotomies. One person manages to create something brand new and run it on one machine, and then they hurl it over the fence to someone who runs it on the other 100,000 machines. And I think working together, we need to do that. So we'll talk about how we, instead of just duct taping things together, begin to gradually modernize at everything from the entire portfolio level down to the single application level. And I've started to have a number of these conversations already. I had a conversation with a customer here who worked for an ISV who developed software and was talking about their application, their very valuable years-long investment in Windows Forms. And he's like, everyone's telling me it's old because we kind of have that habit. We make something new. We want to make you feel ashamed of having the old stuff. Having old stuff is okay. It's just limiting if you want to do more stuff. And so we began to have the conversation of, well, what should we do with this? Should we take all of our existing stuff and throw it away because there's a lot of really super valuable IP? Should we go to a similar technology a la WPF rather than staying in Windows Forms or jumping all the way up to HTML5? Then we talked about HTML5. They happen to, in particular, be in the pharmaceutical industry. HTML5 gives you a dependency on platform pieces that we both are very well aware aren't really widely known in the pharmaceutical industry. We've got some really tough decisions to make, and so how do we help make them without just saying old is bad? We also have people who aren't aware at all of the fact that what they're doing is not taking advantage of the platform. This is another thing that I think it's relatively easy for us to forget. We've made MSDN this giant catalog of everything a developer needs to know. It's all right there for you. Just sit there and scroll through all of it, and you'll write really good code, because you got time for that, don't you? Developers, you just flip through MSDN looking for tips, right? Let's think about the web, and I'll give a quick example and tell the story of what inspired this. I was working on site, with a customer in London, and they were looking at, do we go to IE8, do we go to IE9, what decision should we make there? And so they were thinking, well, IE9 is a really good performance story, I'm seeing the numbers, I'm seeing the blogs, so they put it out to the people. And a developer walks in, kind of storms in with his laptop, and he's like, IE9 and performance, I don't think so. This really sucks. Watch this. He's going to show me a thing or two. He pops open his laptop, goes to his website running on Firefox. He's like, look at how fast that is. Popped open IE9 and says, look at how not fast that is. So I took a look at the site. I'll just pick a random website here, and I pushed F12 to get the developer tools open, and noticed immediately the document mode that it was running in was not standards, it was Quirks mode. For those of you who are not familiar with how we do compatibility in Internet Explorer, with each new release of Internet Explorer, we tend to keep along the older rendering engines. We started doing this with IE6. In IE6, if you do not put a doc type in your code, we continue to run you in IE5.5 compatibility mode using the actual engine. It's a monolithic chunk of code that does the rendering, the script processing, the rules enforcement. The one thing that we carry between the two of them are the security features. And then we added this new revolutionary, highly standards compliant IE6 compatibility mode, which at the time made it one of the most standards compliant browsers that the world has seen, better than the other commercial ones, believe it or not. Right? Of course, now the standards compliance really is kind of terrible. But at the time, we were even on the cutting edge of some things that ended up not panning out the way the specs looked at the time that we implemented it. So we had two. The developer opted in by putting in a doc type. The challenge with that, the number of developers I've talked to in the world who know what doc types are and do and why they're there has so far been one. Is there anyone else here who's doc types and knows all about them? Heard of them? So it's still one. So we had an opt-in technology that we thought, what a perfect solution. It sounds great, doesn't it? Except no one got the memo. Then we went to IE7 and we said, all right, well, IE7, let's keep these two guys. We updated the standards compliance mode on the assumption that if you chose standards compliance and we gave you more, you'd be happy for that. But we kept Quirks mode. We went to IE8. We made such a big breaking change in our standards conformance that we made another one. But we said, wow, it's so breaking, we need to keep the old standards one. We still need Quirks because this is the default. So then we had three. And then IE9 came out and we said, oh, well, we're actually doing HTML5. It's totally different. It's breaking. So let's keep the ones we previously had. And then for IE10, we're adding a new IE10 implementation of standards, more of HTML5. Some things have evolved. And to make things even more fun, we've added in a second Quirks mode that looks a lot more like the Quirks mode implemented by other browsers, so that when you're on the public internet and if you render a Quirks mode web page on Firefox or Chrome or IE, they'll all look the same because they don't do what IE5.5 did. But we have to keep the old IE5.5 Quirks one because there's lots of sites that still depend on those. Boy, that's not going to be confusing for anybody. So we have this incredible depth of compatibility infrastructure. No one knows about it, and they were running it in Quirks mode. And so I said, well, let's try running it in standards mode. As I had it, I thought it was a fairly safe bet that if it was working on Firefox, unless it were rendering down different HTML, it should also work on IE9 in standards mode. And I said, let's try it out. And I dropped it to standards mode on IE9, and immediately it was not only as fast as Firefox was, it was faster. And then I thought to myself, I never really explored the idea of if I run things in different modes, are they faster or not? I heard the marketing stuff of fast, you know, it's all these investments around performance, but I'd never really thought about what about the different modes. So I figured I'd try it. And I tried it at the time, and we'll do it again here live because it's fun to take your life in your own hands. I'll show you the data that I collected, which I posted on my blog, which is at appcompatguy.com. I went through and ran the SunSpider test. I figured that was nice and even between all of them and said, how do things compare between all of them? And that just got resumed for some reason. Let's kick it back up to maybe 125 to make it easier to read. This is what I found when I ran it on IE9, that in Quirks mode, you were literally running 10 times slower than you would run on one of the two modern rendering modes. You could, in fact, if running on IE9 standards, you could run faster than anything else available at the time. We were even beating Firefox and Chrome. So this is Firefox 6 and Chrome 13. They're about 6 or 7 versions out of date each, which means this data is at least a week old. Some of you got that. That's IE9. The question is, does IE10 do things any different? So we'll just go ahead and run it. But this is a challenge. It's fantastic that your existing websites will continue to work, because then you don't have to touch them. In an enterprise environment, the average number of developers per website is 0.1. You got one guy in charge of 10, and I've seen it up to one developer who owns 100 websites on average. So you can't go in and go mucking around with the websites all the time, nor should you. What you want to do is figure out, how do I gradually evolve things in a way that's sensible and practical? And we'll come back and look at the outcome of this test. It's a little bit boring to watch a test run through because it takes a couple of minutes, and I have to run it a second time on Quirks mode to show the comparison. But when we think about how we move organizations, right, the organizations that if you make software are trying to buy your stuff, or the organization that you're personally involved with, and it turns out that the people who make software also live in organizations themselves, we have sort of historically tried to go back to our roots. Right? We've just come through what I refer to as the technology dark ages. It was completely possible for you to have looked nearly identical in terms of your baseline client and server technologies in 2001 as you were in 2011. Maybe a couple of version numbers changed, but you could fundamentally do a lot of the same things. Does that seem about right? Did you learn a ton of new stuff about basic technology, or did you just get better at what you did? Very possible. Historically, we're kind of used to skipping around. We used to do this. Anyone who's old like me remembers that. Hey, you know, we used to have mainframes, we used to have, then we jumped and we had some mid-range computers, and, you know, we ended up doing, you know, 16-bit Windows, and it changed from 1 to 2 to 3, and we did, you know, the transition from 16-bit to 32-bit, and then 98 came out, right? The code name for Windows 98 was less S star 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 TY. To fix those things, we did that transition, then to Windows 2000 and the NT code base. We did these jumps every few years, and we got pretty good at doing it. Then we didn't have to for a decade, and now it's like we've forgotten. Then we dig back to what we used to do, which was find all the stuff that's running on it, test it all, and then move. And today that doesn't work because we've managed to build too much stuff. So what ought we do instead? What we ought to do instead is look at those things that we need to look at beforehand and do some work up front to see what we're doing, then look at those things which we'll just catch on the back end, the organic testing. I'm not going to look at it in advance. I'm going to clear up the fact, let us do a pilot, and then let the users let me know if there's a problem. Right? Crowdsourcing your testing, in other words. I don't have anything that's going to block me from putting it out there, right? The same way, so for those who work in a dev organization, if it's anything like how ours works, we do the same thing at Microsoft. Our salespeople, We make sure that the software we use to take orders works before we not only push out, but even make it available for them to install. The other things, some of it might break, and we'll call the help desk when it happens, the same way you already do when your software fails. It's not like we're adding anything new. We're just potentially increasing the frequency or the root cause. The other aspects that don't really get touched on are, how do we govern and list our applications, right? So my devs, when we talk about that, you can take a little nap. I won't be offended. And then talk about, how do we start taking advantage of the new platform? So the IT pros, when we talk about that, if you want to kind of nod off, that's okay with me too. Before we start talking about this, let's go back and see. Oh, wrong button again. I'm programmed for two now. Let's see how we did. So SunSpider JavaScript benchmark is done by WebKit, hanging off of webkit.org. When run in IE10 standards mode, we ran through the whole suite in 359.8 milliseconds. When run in Quirks mode, it's double. So it's no longer 10 times worse. So hooray, your old stuff's not quite as terrible. It's still twice as bad. Doubling your performance simply by updating it, an immediate advantage. Then there's a long-term advantage of recruiting. IE5.5 Quirks is still used in the enterprise on 70% of web applications. 70. The top 5,000 public websites that we track in terms of traffic, and traffic is measured by the internet, we just happen to track which ones they are so we can do outreach. Of the top 5,000, 12.5% are running Quirks mode still. Usually it's not by choice. There's some significant things to be gained. Performance, I'm going to double my performance on 10. I'm going to multiply it by 10 on IE9. That's something worth thinking about. The other is in terms of recruiting. How many college kids you got coming out right now who are like, I've written a whole bunch of code for IE5.5? How many kids coming out of college are running IE? And we'll know how to speak that dialect of HTML. It's going to be the next mainframe language if we're not careful. So we need to be aware of the long-term and short-term ramifications. Let's get to the whole piles, the enterprise piles of things that we need to start digging through. Right? The first one is, how do we start to catch those things that we want to change? Right? When I think about the improvements we most desperately need to make in companies around the world, the first is, how do we help them better leverage software for strategic value? Number one, if we have a problem with a lot of our websites using Quirks mode, how do we stop it? The answer is not go find it all and update all of it. A lot of it won't generate an ROI. A lot of it's perfectly fine to be slow. It's not getting a lot of maintenance time. It's just kind of there and working, and let it alone. Others benefit immediately from some performance increase. What we want to do is not add new stuff that runs on old technology. I about had a fit when we updated Microsoft's internal travel site and they messed up their doc types and ran them all in Quirks mode. And I said, I can't believe our internal site's running in Quirks mode. That's not okay with me. And they're like, well, they didn't know. They didn't think about it. I mean, who pushes F12? Well, I do. First thing I did, that seems a little bit slow. IE9 can go for, oh. How do we stop it and catch it coming in without being unnecessarily restrictive? Because that's the other bit of tension. What do developers like to do? Not be constrained by unnecessary shackles and bureaucracy. I spend a lot of my time fixing auto-updating applications that are installed per machine. The reason why they wrote the auto-updaters is because it was too painful to do it through centralized IT, so they made their own. That works pretty well when everyone's an admin. It starts to break down a little bit when you start having managed users. Not that everyone should be managed all the time, but how do we help to track where we are and what's going on? The middle one is kind of the boring one. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, which is, let's make sure our licenses are in order. I can build an ROI by just saying I won't get sued. I think the interesting stuff is using it to get better value from my software, understanding how I'm managing my portfolio, investing in the parts of my business that are making me money, and pulling back my investments where I'm not making money off of that. And for those customers, as I look at this overall portfolio, finding where you are and figuring out what's my plan to move forward and gradually evolve my way out of that. And I think that's an important aspect. I don't want to put in a requirement that says redo, throw everything away. How do we start gradually adding new perspectives and new components of it? When we look at where most people are in terms of portfolio management, there's a model around this, right? So this sort of comes from the architecture division. And, you know, I go down the architecture side sometimes. I go down the nerd side sometimes. I think architects like boxes more than code. I like a little bit of both. But I think that when we look at mapping out and understanding your capabilities, most people I know are way on the bottom end of this. Taking someone and upgrading them from Windows XP to Windows 7, the first thing they ask is, I don't know what I have. Can you get me an inventory of the software that I'm on the hook to support? Because I don't know what it is. So I'm no longer actively managing my portfolio. I'm discovering what it is that is out there. I don't know what I'm doing, and therefore my enterprise architects are going to have a real hard time figuring out how to support that. And I think of this like being your insurance policy. If IT is going to put itself on the hook to support that, they have a right to have there be a two-way conversation here. So this photo, this is actually a photo that my best friend sent to me. He said this was my night last night. Someone came by and knocked on his door, and he opened the door and no one was there, and he kind of felt some heat and stepped out, and this was going on a couple of doors down. This is not to advocate arson, so please don't take this as encouragement to burn buildings down. But to instead talk about what happened to that family, and they had to have some insurance. And to compare that to how we're doing our insurance policies in the enterprise. Centralized IT is in business now of ensuring that applications keep running. It's their job to ensure productivity and data security, right? That's what IT pros do. Developers are to enable productivity and enable security. Same basic job. They're just responsible for all these applications. Here's what we've done. If you don't know what software you're on the hook to support, and you have to go discover it and then insure it, that's no different than saying, listen, my house just burned down. You know, insurance company, it was your job to discover that I'd bought a house, assume I wanted insurance because it might burn down, and start sending me bills. You didn't, but I need you to build me a new house now anyway. We've separated risk from reward, and separating risk from reward is one of those things that usually has what we call a bad outcome. It's kind of like if we were to sell a bunch of mortgages to people, right, and then take all of the risk that they won't pay the mortgages and bundle them into, like, some kind of securitized thing. Let's just call it a CDO for the sake of convenience, and sell that risk to someone else and just push it all away, give the people who sold the mortgage their bonuses, and they all walk away like this. How could that go wrong? This is what we need to fix. The problem is, how do you do that in a way that's not obtrusive? Of course, you can come up with some draconian way of fixing it. And the IT pro side of things, that the messaging coming from us and other customers is really optimized around the draconian way of doing things. Just make everyone a lockdown user, churn through, and tightly control everything. Don't let them do anything. They have all the same hardware, and it's all very lined up and structured. That doesn't really work that way today. We can't just assume we have one way. Managed, everything's consistent, total control. I was talking to another customer, and who happens to be a friend of mine, about his business. He works in a creative business. He works in a creative business where the IP he's generating has to be kept secret. They do things like make movies, They don't want the movies to show up on the internet beforehand. Data security is super important. But he also has creative people who he wants to just say, hey, listen, if you can be creative over here and capture it somehow with some alternate device that's not this model of laptop, I want to make sure you do that because I don't want to lose that creativity. How do we start to balance things out to say, let's figure out the scenarios in which we have to have a managed device, which we're really good at being prescriptive about, versus an unmanaged device, which feels like Wild Wild West, but we're not really looking to move to that as our strategy, but just to say that can be okay sometimes. How do we have a lightweight method to figure out where we are and make it better in those places where it adds value? The first step is to figure out where you are. Right? Like I said, most people are in the big bin of, I don't know what I have. I don't know what's important. I've got to figure this out. I don't know who uses these things. I don't know, in some cases, what my business strategy is, where this is relevant. So let's look at what it is that we know, how much do we know about our portfolio, what do our licenses cost, figure that out. Figure out what my urgent problems are, because that's the next thing that normally comes up is people realize, oh, once I figure that out, I've got some security problems here. I have dependencies on having auto updaters. I have custom software distribution solutions built and running in the organization. That is one of the hardest things I've found to get rid of, because if you are a person who's written the custom software distributions and management software, you've ended up with this sort of grungy, low-level code writing job that that person loves and never wants to go away. They don't want to make websites. They just want to write grungy OS-level code, and they'll hold on to it for dear life. And in their grungy, low-level code, they usually embed admin credentials for the entire organization in plain text, which is not so awesome. So what have we found? Have we started to manage things around when's it going to end of life, right? When we have something released, is it just, oh, here you go? And I totally get, having written enterprise software for the first half of my career, that the job is normally, hey, we need this app. It's going to drive this business capability. You're like, all right, yeah, you know, I could get that done in about 6-7 months. You're like, yeah, no, I need it Thursday. Okay, well, let's see what I can make happen. We get it to the point where it compiles and it runs, seems to solve the business problem. It's usually not designed to be service packed, and eventually retired. It's distributed because it compiled. So how do we start planning that and building it to be maintainable? How long does the average enterprise web application run? 12 years. How long are they designed to run typically? Couple. I had a customer, we were having a conversation about their specific application, and they said, listen, we have this one, it's written in VB4, it's a 16-bit, right? So they used a 16-bit compiler too, that was awesome. And you know, we figured it'd be around 3 years, we've had it for 12, and if we do our best guess at when we would ever replace it, we think 12 to 15 more, and then we'll retire it. What can you do for us? It was never designed to last that long, but it ended up lasting that long. So how do we address those things that we found and assign a dollar value to them? How do we look at overall governance and managing for value? So we've addressed the critical issues. Now let's look at how we can start managing them in the ways that are important to start driving innovation, to start driving new capabilities, to get developers, and believe me, as a developer myself, this is what I want. Who loves maintaining all their old code? Certainly not me. You know who the worst developer I've ever seen is? The me from 5 years ago. That guy did not know how to write any code. I don't want to maintain that code the rest of my life. I want to create new capabilities and have fun and innovate. How do we get me doing that and contributing to the business again? And start to increase value. Start to take the overall contribution I have to something that's differentiating. Because we consistently undervalue those things. We undervalue happy employees. We undervalue productivity. We undervalue innovation because it happens too long before the dollars come out, or it's too hard to tie them together. And anyone who assigns those intangible benefits no value prefers to be completely wrong than to be vaguely right. I love this quote. This comes from the Harvard Business Review, and it was about something totally different, but nonetheless impacts the same thing. So how do we start measuring value? Right, in my other session when we start talking about sort of best practices for app compat, I give a formula. How much is the software going to cost you if it fails? So what's the cost of failure, and how likely is it to fail versus how much it's going to cost you to test it? If the cost of failure multiplied by the probability of failure is less than the cost of testing, then you should test. No, you should not test. Well, I can't even do my own math right. Do the cheaper one. Don't spend $1,000 to avoid a $100 fine. The problem is, how much is your software worth? If you sell it, it's got a price tag on it, but in an organization, how much is it worth? How much is its downtime going to cost you? Most people don't know that. How do we achieve that? Because you can't quantify that. And a lot of times, you would never be wise to try to quantify that because, unfortunately, you are very much bound by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The act of measurement would itself distort the outcome. So what surrogates can we use? Some of the surrogates are, how much risk are we taking with the application? Can we measure whether this is going towards something strategic or not? Just like your portfolio. You'd like to have some investments that aren't going to pay off. Hopefully you work for a company that lets you fail sometimes. But you want to have some higher risk activities with the potential for higher payoff. If you track and look at, hey, all of this is conservative stuff, that's not going to drive me forward. How much of this is infrastructure versus giving me actual platforms and applications and capabilities? How much of it's glue code? Because overall, the whole industry is moving towards have less glue code. Right? That's what the cloud is all about. The cloud is all about, listen, if you're writing logic to sort of push things around and line up your own queues, you're not spending your money very well because that problem has been solved by someone who will sell it to you at a commodity price and will probably do it better than you. That's not to say we don't have any, but let's try and get our percentages down and look at moving the stack and seeing where it aligns there. How much of our investment is new investment versus sustaining? How much is maintaining old code or new ways to solve the same problems versus solving new problems or adding new capabilities? On average, most people start off with mostly sustaining technologies. Not because they thought that was a good idea, but because of what we've all been through since around 2007, 2008, where they took all of our departments and said, yeah, you know how you had 30 people? Yeah, we're looking at, we think you're okay with, I don't know, 4. And then you figure out some way to make it work. Are there ways that we can start to prove that, and are we on track to do that? And then this is the way that I personally really like to look at it, is improving the ratio so that fewer and fewer of the investments you make are around maintaining a system of record and more are about either differentiating or innovating. Innovating, I think, is always really hard to quantify, but something that differentiates you. We spend a lot of time doing commodity stuff. I think about that in terms of some of the work that we do within my consulting organization. We do factory work, which is all about how do we go through and take a bunch of CDs, DVDs, setup.exes, and turn them into batch deployable silent MSIs, right? Kind of commodity work, right? And a lot of that is completely core, not differentiating. How do we transmit bits over to here? How do we run through and run this process to get out the other side? That doesn't differentiate us unless it makes it go a lot faster, unless it makes it go with less human interaction. But the basics don't differentiate us. And the more we have of that system of record, non-differentiation, keep the lights on approach, the less technology is contributing to the business. When we think about the applications themselves, let's drill down. So that's from the portfolio side. What about the individual app side? How do we start to approach this? And those who have gone through and tried to do it all at once usually end up just killing the project. It doesn't make sense. I had, for example, one customer that went from IE6 to IE8, and they were like, all right, you know, IE9 looks pretty compelling, because let's be honest, IE9's a way better browser than IE8 was. Not that that's the world's greatest achievement, but they were looking at it, and they're saying, okay, we put in all of these compatibility rules in place to keep it working. We use the duct tape. The duct tape makes us feel dirty. Let's get rid of the duct tape. So let's target that, getting rid of all of it. So we're going to not allow you to do all of these duct tapey things anymore. And if you make it so that it becomes a new rule for everything that already exists, and you don't let things grandfather in, you end up hitting a lot of walls. You hit budget constraints. You hit lack of success. Lack of success leads to lack of sponsorship, and that becomes a very significant problem. Making it opt-in is the better approach. And by opt-in, the model that I normally use and use to facilitate this conversation is to start to understand what you know, what you have, and what it's doing, to start to map it out against, well, which are the things that are generating value for the business, and which are the things where I have high data sensitivity, because that's always the problem that we face. When we're dealing about taking an application and enabling it in new scenarios, it's really easy for me to understand the ACLs as implemented by a PC on a lockdown desktop and what that's going to enable over a closed network connection. And that's very simple, but constraining. What if I wanted to have some other front ends to it? Where would I do that? And it becomes a matter of understanding, where could I strategically invest in taking some software and modernizing it and adding some new abilities to do this. Going back to the earlier example of the customer I was chatting with who was building software for the pharmaceutical industry, he said, we could potentially put it in new platforms. We've got requests to do things on the web. We could replatform the whole thing for the web and rewrite all of our code. But then, since we're in a historically conservative industry, right, there are healthcare and pharmaceutical as an adjunct, as well as financial, are the three industries that tend to move more slowly, right? Healthcare and financial, typically because no one player is influential enough to move the whole market. And financial, certainly players are plenty large to influence their suppliers, but they're just incredibly conservative because of the potential cost of failure. In their case, they said, listen, we could port the whole thing over, but that didn't make sense to us. What we wanted to do was to start to identify, not just thinking of software as this specific monolithic entity, but what is the capabilities and the scenarios I'm putting around this data. Let's figure out where my sensitivity cutoffs go, because in their case, they would have validated circumstances. Things had to be locked down when they have things in labs. That has to be on a controlled machine. So we normally look at what are the cutoff points at which you have what level of control over the machine. Most people have the cutoff point of you've got to be a managed device if you want to run this app. Most people then have a second cutoff of, all right, so here's the other things you can do from outside. Most commonly, email. You can do email in most organizations from just about any device that you want to. I have no idea if that's thunder or something rolling, but I've noticed that the top floor of this place is a little noisy. So I just start graphing it, right? This is kind of boring, non-nerdy things to do, and believe me, I'm the guy who rolls around in assembly language all the time, but this is the way that we take the conversation forward to say, listen, where do you have to be managed? You've already got it managed, so let's leave that there. What are the new scenarios you want to enable, and does it fall in terms of a data criticality at a point where you put it on either a device that's not completely managed and owned by us, but you would be willing to put it on a device where we put an agent on? Email with Exchange ActiveSync is a great example. You can have this within Microsoft on any device you want to, though we do somewhat frown on iPhones. I think at one point we had about 10,000 people who had them, and they all were getting email with them, as long as they obey a policy. or allowed to have an agent or whatever that criteria is. Define that criteria and figure out, hey, well, if I can define a policy, will you let me have it? It won't be a managed device, though. And in what circumstances will you allow me to have a completely unmanaged device and do it anyway? Like Word. I can use Word on any device I want to and write a document for work. And then check it in. And then once it gets checked in and becomes part of our communal IP, perhaps it becomes managed. But there are plenty of things that would run lots of places. It's just easier to think about it as everything's always on a managed device, but they don't have to be. So we were talking about how we might be able to identify some scenarios where it made sense to add that capability and that scenario, not the whole app. So if we have people who are contributing to the business who are working in an offshore environment, let's give them a UI that makes more sense to them. Working with a customer it was public education, they were the inspectors who would inspect the buildings. Rather than bringing all of the business inspection software, we took the subset that simplified their lives and put it on tablets so that they could walk around with just that device and create that. And looking at that specific scenario rather than taking the whole thing. We get boxed into seeing apps as opposed to seeing things together. And the next critical aspect is figuring out how to slice off parts of the app to put the app into different scenarios. How do we piece things together? So when I think about composing an app where I've got a data tier sitting somewhere in business logic, or the same N-tier architecture we've been doing for 10 years, but I want to put usually multiple heads. Many thought that the web would make that go away. We could all do web applications. Turns out the iPhone version 1 shipped with the web browser. People still seem to kind of like apps. So how do we put apps in the hands of the people who want them to do their business? Well, by slicing it off. You know, we're working with a lot of internal applications that are trying to do exactly that. We've got the Link app. Link is a full-fledged app. It used to be Microsoft Office Communicator and who knows what beforehand, because every now and then we just rename stuff. And we are able to put the head of that app with the big server backend onto the phone, onto our phone, onto other people's phones, and divide that up. OneNote. We can put on different devices. Isn't OneNote on the iPad now? So we sliced off the head. So how do we take that and skim off the part that needs to be on the device and put the rest up there? The second is, how do we have the things that need to be on the server in this particular way and instead start to use some of the cloud-based approaches, private or public, and redesign them for that? We need to build those chops. Here's the hard part of this conversation. Outside of the case studies, which I'm working to put together, how do you generically tell people how to refactor your app that way? I would have loved to have had a wall-to-wall session of nothing but demos where we take and reslice applications and refactor them. But every single application I've seen has been a different experience. Most of the time in our stuff, we have mounds and mounds of C++ code that we've got to ferret our way through. Most enterprise applications have mounds and mounds and mounds of Visual Basic 6 code, right? And it's kind of an interesting bit of advice to try to give. Should you take your VB6 and upgrade it to VB.NET? Or should you just take it and leave it in VB6? Because guess what? VB6, I don't know if you've been following this. Did I get the right one? I did. Visual Basic 6, Windows 7. That's actually a lie. Wow, we've dropped in the hit ranking here. One of the higher ranking ones is a complete and total falsehood. We updated to clear our support for VB6 and Windows 8. The VB6 runtime will be shipped and be supported in Windows 8 for the lifetime of the OS. The runtime will. So your existing assets, because I don't know of any company in the world that doesn't have piles of VB6. and it will continue to be supported for Windows 8. Well, now you've got a tough choice, which is if I have existing VB6 code, should I redo it? Should I do it all as VB.NET? Should I leave some? Should I recompile it? If I'm refactoring it, what should I do? So we've started to take some customers and say, you know what, some of this stuff, it's going to be a big job to update it to .NET. If you can take COM as your glue technology for now on the stuff that sits together, you can go piece by piece as you're evolving it. So there was a step one of create new VB6 things that didn't used to exist, which kind of sounds like what you normally don't want to do, but that was an enabling step towards stage two, which was now start taking those and say, listen, if I'm going to make any changes, because all I did there was sort of refactor, regroup, and recompile and did nothing new. Step two was now let's start taking these capabilities and say, hey, what am I investing in now? Do the conversion, then do the investment, and now that one's managed, still glued together with COM. And then when I'm done, I can start gluing them together in different ways using, well, I probably wouldn't use SOAP these days, I'd probably use REST, and starting to glue those together. To gradually move things forward. The other thing to always keep in mind, and this is always really hard to think about when you're betting on the technology. It's really easy to think about when it actually happens. Eventually, everything becomes irrelevant. Some things sooner than others, some things more predictably than others. How many of you have ever used WSI? Web Services Extensions, which has let you do things to support the WS Star APIs. Kind of came, there's a lot of hype, right? Our DPE organization is great at getting people psyched up. WSI then kind of gradually faded away. It became irrelevant. And sometimes those investments get irrelevant more quickly. One of the things I've been hitting a lot more on the web, and you may have noticed from my sort of continual reference to the web, I'm not actually never was a web guy, but it's the thing that most people are talking about now because it's what's moving the fastest and where there's the most value in moving forward, so that's what I end up talking about most. On the web, what do most people today at least consider using along the way? jQuery and jQuery UI. We use it at Microsoft. Really popular. How do they use it? It's middleware. Don't be confused by the fact that it's a .js file and not compiled. It's middleware. You download the JS on the whatever one is available on the day that you decided to use it. You stick it in your project. You start building your application. You write all the JavaScript code. You're leveraging these great technologies. You stick it up on the web. You're done. And you never again change the JS file, not noticing that that becomes irrelevant really quickly. As new browsers come out, and if you're supporting the three primary browsers in the world, you will notice new browsers coming out about once every 6 to 8 weeks. They introduce new bugs in the framework, or you discover bugs in the new platform that get fixed in subsequent versions. Either way, the old one stops working. When I deal with upgrades to IE9, the number one thing I end up doing at most of the customers I work with is finding out, all right, let me go look at, you know, which version of jQuery you're running, because you got to be on at least this one to have IE9 support. Oh, yep, no, you're about 20 versions older than that, so let's get you on something newer. Everything becomes irrelevant. If we think we can make a big all-in bet and never put a hedge down, we're going to end up being sad. And this is the same challenge as is for the IT pro, but for the developers, is when you make a bet, how are you going to hedge the bet? What's going to happen when WSI goes out of support? What's going to happen when .NET 1.1, not yet out of support, but guess what? Not supported on Windows 7. So you could keep running Vista or XP and get 1.1 support until 2013. You just can't get support on Windows 7. Doesn't mean it doesn't work, but our support lifecycle is 5 years mainstream. Mainstream is where we get compatibility support. 5 years extended. That's where you just get security. My biggest pet peeve, the biggest challenge, what scares me every time I go in someplace. Eventually, everything becomes irrelevant or dangerous. These are the number of active exploit detections against various bugs in Java runtimes. Nearly every customer I visit can tell me exactly and precisely which version of Java they support, and you're not allowed to use a different one. I had one that was updating their support. We used to support 1.3 update 17, and we are moving forward to 1.5 update 5. This was 2 months ago. Java 1.5 went end of life 18 months ago at update 22. So they were 17 versions out of date on an already expired platform, and they were just moving there. And that is exposing them to vulnerabilities in the software because security updates come through platform updates. You don't get them any other way. Historically, they used to maintain three at a time. So when Windows 7 came out, there was a supported 1.4, 1.5, 1.6, but they gradually killed them off. And if you have an old one, guess what? People can hack you. And you know what? They're doing it. There's a huge spike in Q4 of 2010. Why did they start doing it? Because that's when they realized, wait a minute, enterprises, the folks that make a lot of money, are all still running this old stuff, and it's incredibly well known how to exploit it. That might not be such a good idea. Right? Because it feels different. Right, so we have vulnerabilities that we patch in the .NET framework, which is a very similar concept to a Java runtime. People don't tend to lock in on the .NET framework 2.0 with the updates from Windows Update through September of 2007, which is a lot like locking in on an old 1.3 framework. And they're resistant because compatibility can sometimes trump security in their eyes because they're not the security guys. Had a great conversation. Hey, we're having this problem here. We have this app that needs Java 1.3, and it's causing all of my other apps to fail. What can you do? Well, I would fix the app, because you know the reason why it needed that version of 1.3? Because it was checking the version and failing if it didn't find 1.3. You know how we fixed it? We took the version lie out. Sorry, the version check out. Boom! Worked fine. There's another interesting statistic about that version check. So I'll just say, when it comes to modernizing stuff, stop checking versions, and you'll have an awful lot easier time, as will I. Commercial software, in the Windows product team, we test about, 3,000 or more applications every single day with every daily build of Windows. And in preparation for the developer preview, we looked at how many applications that used to work on Windows 7 and didn't work on Windows 8. 17%. Of which 100% of those were version checks. A couple of them had some other issues too, but the predominant issue, other than AV, right? So AVs always are doing stuff in the kernel and they always require an update, but just regular old apps. What version are you? Oh, you're not Windows 7? I'm not gonna like you. It's the only bug I've hit in any software that I've run so far. So I've kind of been flipping back and forth between the two, so I'm kind of not a super structured demo guy. But when we start thinking about modernizing, we need to think about different constructs. And I'll stick to the web one more time and think about that. But this was an example of an application which is now failing in a totally different way. So let me make it fail in the way it used to. There we go. Now we're failing in the way it used to, and the zoom is wrong, though. Here, let me get the zoom set up again. Oh, you are at 100%. Okay, so now we should open and be at 100%, and we should be in, let's go back to IE5 quirks, and this is what they were running in, and this was the bug. Gradually modernizing requires you to kind of understand your platform and what you're going to do. So if you're thinking about the web, the number one way to modernize is start using a more modern engine. Because what you would like to be able to do, depending upon your scenario, is get outside of the confines of we must strictly manage which version of the browser that you use. So this customer used an approach that they thought was going to work pretty well for them, which was in order to minimize differences between browsers, they were going to use Quirks mode, because Quirks mode on IE6 is the same as Quirks mode on IE7, is the same as Quirks mode on IE8, is the same as Quirks mode on IE9, and is not precisely the same as Quirks mode on IE10. So problem number one, it's a different Quirks mode. Problem number two is that they're using different constructs. If we look at what they're building, what they've built here is something wherein they wanted something pixel perfect. And they found that this was not pixel perfect. This was wrapping. And they wanted it to be a single line. It was causing everything to be taller and this whole thing. And they're like, why did this happen? We're using Quirks mode. Quirks mode should always be the same. What's fascinating is that this came up again for IE10. How can we guarantee that Quirks mode will never again change a single rendering? Because we broke it on IE8. And actually, technically, we broke it on IE8 on Windows 7. We did so because Windows 7 added new fonts. And the new fonts were of slightly different size than the old fonts. So then they resolved that and used the new fonts. Then we broke it on IE9 because this is wrapping. Turns out it's wrapping because of subtle differences in subpixel rendering between the direct 2D text rendering we do in IE9 and the GDI rendering we did at IE8 and earlier, which put it slightly off, and they were gunning for it by just expecting something would never change. And then when I went and took a look at what this one was, I found that they're using an HTML table. Modernizing. Are HTML tables modern? How do we do tables today? Anyone? Bueller? CSS? Right. And the reason why, I mean, just the world evolved. The challenge with HTML5 tables for this problem, their hope was they never wanted to change everything again. They wanted it to always be the same. They were using a structure called the table to create this. And if we look at the middle line here, here's the problem with chasing pixel perfect perfection. If column widths prove to be too narrow for the contents of a particular table cell, in this case because we subtly changed the rendering and got one pixel off in a couple of places on the many forms they have, user agents may choose to reflow the table. Its job is to reflow. The original goal behind HTML was, let's just make something that's dynamic reflow. Any screen size, it always looks right. As you resize the window, it'll just reflow itself. But designers don't like to design for dynamic things because they can't predict it. They design for an exact width. They open a new window specifically so they can demand a particular width when opening it, put it into a table structure, and then got mad when the table structure reflowed itself as subpixel differences sometimes push things over the top. Wrong construct. So how would you modernize this? Right, this is a real application. This is a real company that made this application that now has the challenge of how would I go about modernizing it? They serve customers over whom they have no control. Does anyone here speak Japanese? Okay, so I'm okay with, I have honestly no way. I speak enough Japanese to get fed and find hotels and bathrooms, but that's about it. That's a really good investment of my 4 years of time in high school when I studied it, is I can actually get some food and, you know, good job, 4 years of studying. I am a whiz with languages. Hopefully there's nothing terribly destructive up here, but It's a real business problem. This is their real application. So I want you to just kind of stop and think about what they could do to solve this problem. They don't have control over it. It's an insurance company. They have agents. Every single agency, just like here in the U.S., is a private entity, their own business. So they can't just give out a standardized laptop and say, here's your laptop with the browser I want. They have to support anything. They're very liberal in that. Right? AOL used to be the same way. AOL supported any version of AOL when they released 9, which 9 is actually 4 different things, and they still supported back through like 4, and then earlier than 4 they just couldn't. They supported any browser. You come at it with IE6, IE5, IE4, IE7, IE8, they want to support IE9. Occasionally people get new computers, but if you have an old computer and you've kept it going for 5 years, they want to not have them be the ones that wreck your day. At the same time, it's important to them, for whatever business reasons, to not lay out differently on different platforms. So what would you do? Right? And this is the conversation we're having. First thing is, from an architecture standpoint, they've got it pretty well factored. So we're more interested in just updating the user experience components. Everything else is running in the cloud. As a web-based app, you usually start there. Had this been a VB6 app, it would have been different. We would have had a thicker client. We'd evolve it differently. As a web app, we had a design that most of the things were running in the quote-unquote cloud. But we need to think about the user experience that we were putting together. So step number one was, how do we solve the problem of any computer looks the way that they need it to? Question number one then is, do you need it to always be pixel perfect, or is that a made-up requirement? Because that happens. We don't challenge requirements all the time. Do you actually need it? So we're pushing on that one. Are you just being, you know, anal retentive but not adding value by having it? Or does it genuinely add value? Question number two is, what approach are we going to use for making an experience for everyone? Do we use CSS? Because CSS has changed kind of a lot. So which one are you going to use? Are you going to continue to use Quirks to get that consistency, or are you going to baseline at, say, IE8 or something later? What we do, as an example, in SharePoint 2010, because, you know, we're going to ship that thing, and then you're going to run it, and then we're going to just not have the ability to touch much other than service packs. We pin it at IE8. We use XUA compatible, which I talk about that in my blog as well, is my recommendation for making durable applications is to use XUA compatible and tag your websites to a particular rendering engine so we'll continue to run it. In fact, if you want to not run Quirks mode or 7 standards, you have to do one in the local intranet zone or you won't get the modern engine. That's why a lot of enterprises think IE9 is not as good as we do, because they're not doing that yet. So their approach is, number one, figure out what's a real requirement versus what's bogus and just, I don't want to change things that happened in the past. Number two, figure out, which rendering technology do I use? Do I want to pin it to 8 or 9? 9 is HTML5, but it's going to be a while before all of their customers use it. Do we do it at 8? That's what we did for SharePoint. Next version of SharePoint is likely to pin it to IE10 standards. Again, moving things forward. We in SharePoint said, we'll do 8, we'll support you on 7, you can't come at us with 6. So they have to next determine, do they have a business case to stop supporting 6? Based on market share, you can always find that at the IE6 countdown, and turns out Japan still has a 5% market share for IE6, so maybe they can't. Change the technology, use CSS, figure which set of standards, how far back can they go, do they need to do code branches, and then figure that part out. And the other thing was, should they start building apps for other form factors? So should we build an iPad app that lets you enter it as an app? And if we get it factored to the point where we start to build some constructs that we can assemble them and compose them into UI constructs and build them once, can we then just reuse those across apps to make that much more reusable so we're not building entire forms? That's another one of the avenues that we're approaching. And I know this is not super prescriptive, and I'm trying to figure out how to be more, so please be as candid as you can. as far as what kind of information would help. But walking through that, the last thing I wanted to close with was when we think about VB6, our most pronounced legacy application or platform in the world, how long did you get it? I thought this was a really interesting comparison. We gave you a supported VB6 for longer than you got Buddy Holly, for longer than you had the Betamax or XP, longer than the great warranty you'll get on your Hyundai or the slightly less great warranty you'll get on your BMW. And for those who say, I am sick of the fact that VB6 support is ending after only 25 years, I'm going to move to Firefox, that's a bit of an empty threat. So with that, I hope this was helpful. I wanted to start the conversation. My email is appcompatguy@microsoft.com. We're just kicking off this initiative. We're trying to figure out how to do it right. Feel free to nail me against the wall or tell me more. Just tell me in words so that we can do a better job and start to really help you take what you've got out of the technology dark ages and bring it to the future. Thank you. Any questions? We actually have like 8 minutes left, which is kind of unusually kind of me to have left that for you. Yes? Can I get you to, I'll repeat your question if I can hear you, but I'm struggling to hear you a little bit. Or you can do it in the mic, and then we can solve both problems with one stone.
We're embarking on our Windows 7 enterprise deployment.
Uh-huh.
And I heard, I'm not a Windows expert, but I heard that so our strategy is for applications that can't rewrite, like it's a giant effort to rewrite it, to get it to be natively compatible on Windows 7, we want to virtualize it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that the virtualization platform depends on the underlying OS, and Windows Server 2008 R2 is the same code base as Windows 7. So if you're running a virtualization, anything like Citrix App, Ethernet, whatever,
mm-hmm.
if it's based on Server 08 R2, it won't work.
Yes, so if you have an app that doesn't work on Windows 7, Server 2008 R2 is going to have all of the same rules, and it probably won't work there either. So if you just wanted to put it on a TS server and serve it down using remote app, which would be awfully convenient, then it won't work. And to get parity on the server side, you have to go to Server 2003. Server 2003, rather inconveniently, doesn't have remote app. You have to put third-party software on it. Citrix does that. Quest does that. Rather inconveniently, Citrix's latest stuff no longer supports Server 2003.
Right.
So you've got to dig into their old stuff if you're a Citrix shop. Quest's new stuff does work on Server 2003. And then you have you buy yourself an extra year by going server. Whereas if you went to VDI and had XP running somewhere, you still got the same end of support. You just got Windows 7 earlier. You've bought an extra year because I think Server 2003 doesn't go end of life until 2015.
Okay. So our constraint internally, our server team is end of life in 03. Like they're embarking on the effort to remove that from the environment at the same time as we're embarking on removing XP from the environment. So
mm-hmm.
is that the only option, is to retain either VDI XP or some version of 2003 running some virtualization suite?
There are other techniques for fixing it, but if you want to just run it on a platform on which it works, right? And so normally there are a few software issues that you can't resolve with any other means other than changing code. And changing code or buying a new one, it can often be expensive and time-consuming, so you use virtualization as your bridge. There are a few like that. But you know, it's never the long-term approach for how to solve it.
Yes, yeah, certainly. Well,
right.
So we're constrained on one end because we're starting late. We're constrained on the other end because, you know, we're up against the retirement dates.
Mm-hmm.
And we've only got so much money to throw at the problem. So I guess we're looking for an out. If we can't rewrite something just because of time and material, you know, what options do we have, I guess? And so it sounds like somewhere...
Yeah, keep
somewhere
running it.
Somewhere.
I mean, in essence, what you're doing, yeah. What you're trying to do is run less of it.
Yeah.
Right? And in progress, not perfection.
Yeah.
right? But if your goal is to have none, yet have everything work, yet do nothing to get them working, you've got some inherent contradictions in the plan that we need to work out. Like, what's going to budge? Can we get more money to do remediation? Can we get, you know, license to leave virtualization on as our duct tape for a while longer, while we go through and resolve the compatibility challenges?
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Okay, great. Well, thanks for coming, everyone.